Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 133 of Registry Matters. Larry, missed you last week. I was sitting right here waiting for you to show up and nothing happened.
Well, I just couldn't make it because I couldn't meet your very high expectations that I come in by Discord.
I guess I do have mea culpas on last week. We just couldn't put it all together and it wouldn't have worked out so well. But no, I wasn't sitting here waiting for you. I'm just totally picking on you.
Yeah, we considered
technology, traveling and so forth. We just couldn't put it together.
We considered doing a telephone interview, but we just ruled that out because we knew that with the high quality expectations that people would tune us out.
That's what I expect. I have heard this confirmed by some people, Larry.
I see.
It's not just me. So, well, did you have a good week off?
We're getting an echo now.
We are that's probably my fault. Did it go away? Tell me if it went away.
Yes.
Okay, good. Well, very good. Did you enjoy your week off?
2 weeks.
2 weeks? Not two well, weeks. I mean, we recorded well, the week
well,
before.
I mean, the week we were off, but I was off work for 2 weeks.
Oh, you got to tell me about any sort of extra equipment that you used. You drove a fair distance from the south to the less than south, and you had some extra equipment that you were wearing.
Are you talking about the shield?
Yes, I am talking about the shield.
So, well, I have a plastic face shield in addition to the standard little mask that everyone wears. So I had double coverage on the airplane. I had 6 plane rides over the course of the trip.
And did anybody say that you were a nut job for wearing all that?
I don't think anyone said it. I'm sure it went through some people's minds.
So did anybody thank you for wearing it, though?
No one thanked me, but I did hear one guy arguing that he wasn't going to wear one because he's an American and he doesn't have to. And it was on the airplane, and they were telling him he had to wear it, required, and he said, I don't have to do anything. And they relented, and he was able to bamboozle or badger his way on the plane.
So, and did you notice a difference between your neck of the woods and this neck of the woods on the people wearing masks and whatnot?
I noticed a significant difference between the, I assumed that Americans were taking it seriously, but when I was in the Southeast, particularly in Georgia and Florida, I didn't notice that seriousness.
I don't understand why, like up in the Northeast, that like they have mandatory orders that if you're in public, or you'll be refused service by going into a grocery store or restaurant without one on. And down here, it's just let it all hang out, man. Run around like nothing's going on.
Well, I see that there was a barista at Starbucks that refused to serve someone, and he's gotten about $60,000 at last count of donations on GoFundMe for taking that position. But I just assume that it was nearly identical. But I would say if one out of every three people in Florida was wearing a mask in public, I'd be surprised. And here in my home city, I would say I would be very surprised if about 75 to 90% of the people are wearing them when I'm in public. I would be very surprised if it's less than that. So I definitely noticed a huge difference in the people that were covering their faces there.
Hey, everybody in chat, just chime in and tell me what you observe being out and about of how many people you see wearing masks and whatnot. Well, let's start driving this bus, Larry. And first thing, I have to deeply, deeply apologize to one of our probably almost longest time listener and Patreon supporter, Jeff from Kentucky. Excuse me. He left a voicemail, and I dropped the ball, Larry, last time we recorded 2 weeks ago, and it is still very relevant. It just happens to be slightly less. It's related to. Well, I'll let Jeff tell you. So here is a voicemail from Jeff.
Hello, Andy and Larry. This is Jeff from Kentucky. I'm also known as Captain Crazy on the old Twitter. So I have a question, and I know Larry likes voicemails. and I thought this was a good question. So the Constitution says I'm allowed to assemble for the purposes of protesting and whatnot, but Kentucky state law says that I am not allowed to go to public parks that have playgrounds. So there was recently a protest at a public park in a playground in my city regarding the George Floyd incident, and obviously I wasn't allowed to go to it. So what does Larry think about that? What would have happened if I had just gone anyway and said I'm exercising my right to assemble? Anyway, you guys have a good Saturday, and FYP.
Thank you for that. I think that's a great question, Larry.
I agree, and this is the first I've heard it, but I agree that's a really good question. And unlike lawyers who will filibuster and pretend they know something, sometimes the answer is we do not know. And truly on that one, we do not know what would happen if you did that. We could assume that if someone recognized you, and when we get to a case that we're going to be talking about out of Illinois coming up here in later in the podcast, this will make more sense to you. We can assume that there's a possibility of prosecution because there will be prosecutors that will say, I put my hand on that Bible and I'm going to do my duty, and that you would be prosecuted. But what we won't know the answer to is what would happen if you raised a constitutional challenge within that prosecution and saying that was trampling your right under the Constitution to assemble and petition government for redress of your grievance. And I had that very same conversation with Robin from North Carolina today on something else, because he was saying that nobody can petition government for redress of their grievances, because everywhere where legislators meet and interim committees and whatnot, and even in the Capitol, that it's within 1,000 feet of something. And I said, well, you know, that I would never allow that to stand. I would challenge that because it's your fundamental right. But in the process of challenge it, as we need to reflect back on history, people have taken stands, have been arrested. Just because you have the right to do something doesn't mean you will not be arrested and prosecuted. So I do not know if you would be prosecuted, nor do I know if you would win. But what I do know is I think you would have an excellent claim of a constitutional violation. And I would hope that we would be able to muster some resources and support for such a challenge if you were to feel inspired to do that in Kentucky.
I can see a delineation of if you're just trying to take your kids to the park to play, that being different than going to some sort of gathering that happens to be at a park to protest the George Floyd stuff.
What do you see as the delineation of that? I mean, there is a slight delineation, yeah. But what do you...
Well, you have the right to assemble for the redress of your grievances with the government. So that would be the delineation. But does that have to be like a formalized protest? Or, I mean, you know, if you're hanging out there with your kid and you're pushing them on the swing or something like that, that doesn't, I mean, is that assembling?
Well, not for the same purpose. But again, you know, that's an area of still developing case law. And the question that Jeff raised is, as far as I know, would be a matter of first impression. I have never heard of anybody attempting to raise that issue. So a matter of first impression, we don't know how it would come out. But there is a difference between wanting to simply visit a park and wanting to assemble and raise your voice in opposition to something that government is doing or should be doing that they're not doing. So there is a slight difference. I was just wondering what you saw as the difference.
Yeah. Well, riddle me this. If it were you, and say you were like 100-something years younger than your picture depicts this evening, would you go do it? If it were, at least if it were an issue, I don't want to say specifically for this one, but if it were an issue that you were super stoked about?
It would be one where I would have to be faced with the circumstances, and I would have to know in advance that we had a plan in place. To just arbitrarily say, I think we had a person said, I ain't going to take no polygraph test. You remember who I'm talking about?
I do.
In Georgia, without a plan, I would not be likely to take that action. But if I had support, if I already knew we had a battle plan and I was ready to be arrested like Rosa Parks was when she said, I ain't going to the back of the bus. If I knew that I had all the pieces in place and this was very important to me, I would do it. But I just wouldn't do it on a whimsical thing to find out what they would do, because what they would do would probably not be something that you would enjoy.
All right, then. So Tread lightly, Jeff. I think that would be the answer.
And we don't know.
We don't know. I do understand. All right, well then we should start tackling some of these articles. And first up, Larry, is something that you wanted to bring up. It says the appeals court orders judge to dismiss Flynn charges. This is so confusing to me, Larry, that I didn't follow it closely, but I know that. So here's a lieutenant general, I believe is what he is. So be my little. So he's a 3-star general. And I thought they actually convicted him of lying to the FBI. Is that what it was?
Well, not quite right. He had pled to that.
Okay.
He had not been sentenced.
Okay. You've said before that if somebody recants their testimony, you know they are a liar and they have lied about either the statement that they made or the recantation that they have now pled or stated. Isn't this feels the same way to me?
Well, it could feel that way, but it really isn't. I mean, he filed a motion after entering the plea to withdraw his plea, saying that the government had breached the plea agreement. And then months later, the government filed a motion saying that they want to dismiss the case. This turns on something I said in previous episodes, and I don't remember which one, but I always have insisted that the prosecution holds all the cards. Right. When it comes down to what a judge can do, the judge is a neutral arbiter. The prosecution decides what charge to bring, what if whether to charge or not, and if the prosecution decides that they do not wish to go forward with a case, they can discontinue their going forward. It's not so far-fetched that after a prosecution has ensued that you might want to drop charges even up until before sentencing. New information could surface that could cause you, as your duty as a prosecutor, to seek justice, to want to dismiss the case. And Judge Sullivan, for whatever reason, decided that he was the one who got to make that decision. And I think I said unequivocally that prosecution rests entirely with the prosecution whether to go forward. The government decided it did not want to go forward. And therefore, they said, we're disengaging from this prosecution. Now, it's a whole other issue or not about whether anything was improper and how they came to that decision. But it is entirely the prosecution's decision. And when a judge says, I won't accept a plea agreement, the prosecutor, all they have to say is, well, judge, you'll either accept it or we have the ultimate trump card. We'll dismiss the case and you won't have anything. So that was the point I wanted to make here, was that the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals did exactly what I expected them to do, was to order Judge Sullivan to dismiss this case. I believe this is the proper ruling, and I believe that it will be upheld if there's two avenues left for that they can take. They can ask for a full en banc review by the full D.C. Circuit, which is seldom granted, or they could file a cert petition with the U.S. Supreme Court. Either way, I believe they'll lose. if the circuit grants en banc review, I think they'll affirm the 3-judge panel, which was a divided panel, but that's the way panels are. If they're not unanimous, you have 2 for, 1 against. It turned out the Trump appointees were for dismissing the case, and the Obama appointee was not in favor. I don't see this as a red or blue issue. I know people are just determined to make everything red or blue. I see this as entirely what the system is supposed to do. The prosecution can decide to dismiss cases or to bring charges or what charges to bring. Where I see it gets a little bit troubling for me is that the Attorney General of the United States, Mr. Barr, has cried his crocodile tears about how the prosecutions can be overzealous and how this prosecution was in fact overzealous and that he wants to do the right thing. And I commend him for wanting to do the right thing in this one case. But as in Rush Limbaugh's case in Florida, when the state prosecutors were on his behind about his phony drug prescriptions he was having written back, at, what was it, 15 years ago, I don't remember. Rush Limbaugh forgot. He talked and ranted and raved on the radio about how the prosecution was overzealous in his case and how they have this inordinate amount of power. And he's been ranting and raving about this case. Rush And Barr, why don't you do something to try to fix the systemic problem we have here? It's nice that you took care of this one case, but we have a systemic problem where we give the prosecutors way too much power. They can beat someone into taking a plea, even though the person thinks they're not guilty. And that's what Flynn said happened to him.
All right, because, you know, CNN is running around saying that this is the most improper use of his power, and Fox is running around saying that, yay, this is what should have happened all along, and this was a bogus case to begin with.
Well, I'm not going to pronounce where it's a bogus case. I have not gotten sufficient information for that, but I don't see anything abusive about the decision. This is exactly the decision that I would, if I were sitting on the D.C. Circuit, this is exactly what I would have done. Now, it is a little bit peculiar that they did it through a writ of mandamus, which is merely a vehicle, that he filed a petition for a writ of mandamus, I think it was. And he could Yes. have done an appeal rather than mandamus is supposed to be seldomly used, sparingly used, and extraordinarily used, and when there's no other remedy. And the panel had some disagreement about whether he had other remedies available to him. But other than that, I agree completely with the ruling. So all the people out there who think I'm a libtard, and I don't know where they get that, because this is exactly what I would have done if I were sitting on that court.
We have talked about, let's talk about that writ of mandamus for just a minute, that good cases have been brought up with good evidence, but they use the wrong vehicle. What is the writ of mandamus? Like, what does that mean? When should it be used, not be used?
Well, it should be used when it's appropriate, Andy.
Oh, of course. I should have known that. But what is it, like, what does that mean?
Well,
I know you're poking at me.
A mandamus is merely when you file something in court, you have a cause of action. The court is filled with causes of action, and they all have their unique set of rules of how and when they're used. So when you're gonna get a divorce, what do you file?
A petition to divorce, I guess.
Or it might be known as a petition for dissolution of marriage.
Okay.
And you file the right vehicle for the cause of action that you're seeking. When a mandamus is used, I have not seen it used in a situation like this. So I agree with the dissenting Obama appointee that this is an unusual remedy. A mandamus is normally used for an agency that should be doing something that it's not doing, or an agency that's not allowed to do something that it is doing. So you would seek to prohibit or compel the agency to do or not do something it's doing. In the case of a judge, the vehicle we would use in this state would be we would file a petition for superintendent control. We would ask the state Supreme Court that we have if this had been a state case and the judge was refusing to dismiss, we would have filed a petition in the state Supreme Court asking for superintendent control for the Supreme Court to say, judge, dismiss the case. But the mandamus is an unusual vehicle. So to the extent they have a claim for anything, that's where their claim is, because it's an unusual vehicle remedy to use. And it's important that you use the right vehicle. So if they were to gain any traction on their arguments, it might be that would where the traction would be that they used a vehicle that really wasn't appropriate for the situation, that he should have taken an appeal on Judge Sullivan. Judge Sullivan appointed this he wanted to keep the prosecution alive, so he appointed amicus. He appointed a parallel prosecutor, and the parallel prosecutor was getting ready to move forward with the case, saying that this case should continue. And that's what it's like. How long should Flynn have to endure that before it's ended? And he had set a briefing schedule to move forward on. The panel said this case has to end because the government has moved for it, and the judge doesn't have the power to not dismiss the case. So the case
prosecution dismiss it.
The prosecution wants to end the case. Now, in the case of the U.S. government, the Department of Justice is the president. People lose sight of that. The Attorney General serves at the pleasure of the president.
Right.
It's not like in your state system where you have elected district attorneys or elected prosecutors from all across your state. In the U.S. government, the Attorney General is the Department of Justice, and the Attorney General serves at the president's leisure. And I didn't design the system, but that's the system we have.
But just to put a cap on that, he isn't there to do the president's bidding either.
Well, what do you mean by that? I mean, he's not there. He's supposed to be doing justice, but if the president, I'm not saying the president called him and asked him anything. I don't have any evidence of that. But if
no,
the president,
I, no, I'm with you on that. I'm not suggesting that. But he's also not supposed to be going the other direction of what you just described, though. He's not also supposed to then go be a hit squad and go use the power of the Justice Department against people per the president's request.
Well, I would agree with that, but does the president forego any opportunity to call up a one of his appointees and say, I'm a little concerned about this situation?
Yeah. Where does that start to get murky and the president having a hit squad in either direction of saying, hey, we got to hit these people with kid gloves, but then we're going to put on the Mike Tyson gloves for this?
Well, I don't know, but I'm just saying the president, if we were talking about any other agency of government, you wouldn't say the president couldn't call and express his concern. Well, why is it that the Department of Justice, the president can't say, gee, I've heard a lot about this case. I find it a little bit troubling. Mm-hmm. I mean, he ultimately could have pardoned Flynn if he wanted to.
Sure.
Because his power to pardon is absolute, and people have gotten. I think we had some expert tell us on one of our episodes about the power to pardon. And I said, no, it's absolute. The president has an absolute power to pardon. There's no restrictions in the Constitution on this power to pardon. And I don't know if it's on the podcast, but someone was telling me that the president. You could impeach the president if he started using the power, clearly in an abusive fashion. But who the president pardons is only the president's concern.
Gotcha. I understand. All right. Well, then let's move over to an article from Tech Dirt, where it says more schools are ending contracts with cops following protests over the killing of George Floyd. Larry, I did not have police in school. There may have been like somebody that would come by on occasion. I think there were like hall monitors that like adults that were making sure that kids weren't running around when they weren't supposed to, but we didn't have law enforcement in the school, and this has always troubled me that there are actually like cops stationed at schools. And so I'm personally pleased to see that, not that I'm happy that this whole thing with George Floyd and the protest has happened, but I'm happy to see that this is a result of it, that the public schools are starting to pull back on having armed officers at schools. This seems, I do not like the idea that the cops are there to begin with. So this seems good to me.
Well, I agree, but there'll be those that are listening that'll tell us that we're completely out of touch, because they will say, you don't remember, but it was Hillary Clinton that talked about the super predators back in the 90s and about how kids were being so violent. And I have always had great consternation about uniforms, in particular armed police officers in our schools. It's bothered me, and it's been in the last 10 years that we've armed our school resource officers here, but until that happened, they were there, but they weren't carrying sidearms. But now they're fully armed, and it's bothered me. And I think that this is a good thing. And I don't know how far this goes, because if there's such a thing as super predators out there, as Hillary referred to them, it may be that some schools need a higher level of security and armaments. But I just relate back to my era in school. I mean, we would never thought of having such a thing. I mean, it's just so bizarre to me that you're running up and down the hall with cops in the school building carrying guns.
Mm-hmm. I've heard this as like the defunding the police, but an alternative police model of, you don't need a cop at a school with a gun necessarily, but you need someone that can be somewhat trained in incident response, that can be a very trained phone dialer to alert higher end officials, you know, better trained armed officials to come in for an incident. We could say Columbine or Sandy Hook, and then Park. What's the one in Florida? What's the one in Florida that happened like 2 years ago?
Parkland. I don't remember. Well, I was gonna say that the people who've lost children in school shootings, they would possibly see it differently, that an armed response than an armed officer would be preferable to being completely unprotected. So I don't know that we would get agreement uniformly that there should be no armed officers in school. I just say I've been very troubled by it.
Yeah. But it's got to be intimidating to the kids there too. I don't know how they would look at it as, do they revere the police as being the almighty saviors of everything? So that makes it a great thing. Is it a PR stunt? Almost like, you know, we have movies that paint the military in these really pristine lights, like, you know, movies like Top Gun. Like the recruiting efforts behind Top Gun were phenomenal. The numbers came out of that, they, you know, hundredfold, something, you know, some crazy number of them having higher recruiting numbers after that. Do you think that people, kids grow up seeing cops in their schools like, wow, that's what I want to do. I want to go be a hall monitor.
I think we should get some teenagers that are in high school today and see what their take on it is. I think it's too distant for us to even relate to.
Probably. Yeah. Cause I mean, you were going to school, like you were like Little House on the Prairie running down the hill, going to your one-room school.
It was in the mid-1800s, actually early 1800s.
You guys were writing on stone tablets.
I was in government in the mid-1800s. Remember, I was in the Lincoln administration.
Did they have paper? You were taking your notes by candlelight and a quill.
That's what we were doing. And when that telegraph thingy came out, that really changed everything.
You guys had news streaming across the country instantly. All right. So over at the appeal, we have Miranda rights weakened by the Supreme Court. How the Supreme Court has gradually weakened the legal protections you have when you are arrested. I would be willing to bet, Larry, that it is just part of your, like, just like, you know, that you can say, I know my rights and I don't have to talk to you. But this is sort of like, this is something that occurred in the 60s to, like, I have to read you your Miranda rights. Before that, there were no protections. And in reading this article, that's pretty lengthy, you can see how things have been torn down since then. But what did people do? Like, the police come to you before the Miranda case, and they would, like, lie to you, and you just had to deal with them abusing you and making you talk?
No, you've always had that right. The issue is of whether or not the cops must apprise you of that, and then what distance they should place between when you invoke your Miranda rights. Should they stop, or are they allowed to keep going? And when can they come back if you've invoked your Miranda rights? Can they come back a few hours later the next day? And I put this in here. It is a very long read, but we've got a conservative-leaning audience who periodically chastise us for being too liberal, and they believe the conservatives are our salvation. And I just would just encourage anyone who has that belief to read this article and watch how the conservative majority in the court that replaced the liberal Warren court, which adopted Miranda in the 1960s, watch how they've chipped away at the Miranda rights, which is one of many things we could cover in the course of this podcast about how the conservatives are not our friend on most things, but they believe with all the of their heart, they believe that if we just had all nine conservatives, that we would just have that we'd be in the promised land. So take the time, read through this, and then come back with your questions or your response next week. But this lays it out pretty succinctly about who's been weakening Miranda, including Judge Thomas, Judge Rehnquist, we can go on and on, but Alito, and the liberals are trying to protect that, and the conservatives have launched all that war on Miranda.
And this comes from, if we would pull as far back as we can, and just like, the conservatives are very pro-law enforcement, that they should have as many tools as they can, and that they would never break their oath to serve and protect. But they use some shady tactics to get you to admit to things or take things out of context after you've been interrogated for dozens of hours. I don't know. That seems you're at a very severe disadvantage when you're dealing with the people with the guns and the tasers and the handcuffs, and that you don't know, like, hey, am I being arrested? Am I being officially detained? That you could just walk out. And I don't know that people feel that they can do that and what kind of impression that would make. It that would be very complicated. You would have to have very big kahunas to just say, well, I'm done here. I'm out.
Well, Take a look at the paragraph. Like I say, people should read it that come from the conservative persuasion. But today's court, I'm quoting, looks nothing like the one that decided Miranda. It is dominated by doctrinaire conservatives whose movements find this for law and order politics cannot be disentangled from their jurisprudence. Judge Clarence Thomas, for example, is notorious for his indifference to the plight of the poor, incarcerated, or otherwise vulnerable people. In 1992, he opined that Louisiana prison guards' brutal beating of a prisoner was not cruel and unusual punishment because the injuries the man suffered weren't serious enough. In 1985,
what do you think serious enough would be?
I don't know. In 1985, Justice Alito boasted that his interest had lost him from, in part, his disagreement with the Warren Court decisions, particularly the areas of criminal procedure, among others. Now, as justice, he has the power to help peel back these decisions himself. And this has been very troubling to me, that the Warren Court was replaced by the Burger Court, which in hindsight looks pretty liberal compared to what has the subsequent Rehnquist, and then the court we have now. And this area, we don't get a lot of favorable decisions out of this conservative court.
Well, there you go. So, Larry, you hate conservatives. That's what we can take from this.
I don't think we could take that from it. Occasionally, they do some good stuff. I've said, like with the Confrontation Clause, we didn't have a stronger supporter of the Confrontation Clause than the late Scalia. He was right on one thing, but he was wrong on so many others.
Somebody asked in chat just before we recorded about, I want to bring this up specifically. Someone asked in chat just before we recorded about, what does anyone think about the restorative justice? And I was just like immediately channeling my inner Larry about confrontation in due process when thinking about that.
Well, it doesn't matter what I think about it. I mean, I tell you what I think about it, but it doesn't matter because that's not our system. We don't have that model. We have the adversarial system. And if you want to tear down the country and rebuild it to your liking, that's fine. There's a process to do that. But in the meantime, we have an adversarial system.
I gotcha. How about we move over to an article from the Law Review and then a subsequent article from CNET about the Constitution protects faces in crowds. And the other one from CNET is geofence warrants how police can use protesters' phones against them. And this all stems from the people going out and protesting, I guess kind of related to Jeff's question earlier, that the police can just get a request from a company like Google for all of the cell phone data, and now they know where you were, and that would potentially create a problem of you having the freedom to assemble. And I think you should be able to assemble anonymously and not have without like all of the processes for a judge to give that data up of to get your whereabouts. But if you think that the police are watching you, then maybe you would have less of a willingness to go out and protest. And just wanted to put it on the radar if people aren't already aware that your phone is the biggest, if you are trying to be anonymous, your phone is creating a huge paper trail of everything that you're doing. All the breadcrumbs that you can leave are being done with a phone for you.
Well, what would you tell me? Put it in a Faraday bag, I think you said.
You could put it in a Faraday bag. You're not going to be able to receive any phone calls.
Well, who the hell needs a phone? Who takes phone calls anymore?
I feel that way, Larry. I don't necessarily ever want to answer phone calls. Like, just send me a text message, honestly. But I do find it problematic that even, you know, if you do have a phone on you, that you have made an agreement with a Google company or a Facebook company. You've made those agreements with them. And then for the government to come in and do a massive dragnet and just get all of the data of all the people that were within this sort of pretty narrow area for a specific time window, that's a whole lot of very innocent people that are being swept into a dragnet for finding somebody that was doing something not appropriate.
Well, the author here of this article, Theodore Claypool, I'm going to have to say he's far more qualified than I am. And he says that you do have such a right to anonymity in a protest, and I'm just not so sure you do. So I would like for people out there in chat that are gurus in constitutional law to decipher the Constitution and tell us where that right is derived to be anonymous. You have the right to petition government for redress of your grievances, but when you petition your senator, you generally tell your senator who you are. I know when I've testified and spoken, they always ask for a name, and I suppose you could give them a bogus name. But I'm not so sure that you have, where does that right in the Constitution? How do they squeeze that right out and say you have the right to do it anonymously?
Riddle me that, well, okay. So something that I heard along the way, I don't remember where it was, is one of the protections that it would almost be like a search and seizure kind of thing. But on the First Amendment side, if you are, let's just throw out something extreme. So you're a white nationalist and you are very against minorities and whatnot, and you're going to little meetings in the woods where you guys wear your little white hoods. You may not want all of your neighbors and all those people knowing what you go do. Or if you are living in a very conservative part of the country and you are going to an abortion clinic, I don't think that those people would want just the general public to know what they're doing. But if you know that you're being monitored, well, you may change your behavior just because you know that you're being monitored, and it would suppress your freedom of speech.
Well, I do agree with you and that it would do that very thing. But it depends on where you do it at. I think Clinton said it depends on the meaning what the word is. If you're out in public space where there's no expectation of privacy, that is different than if you're out on 40 acres of land that's owned by a friend of yours and you're having a hooded get-together. I think that the standard of an expectation of privacy would go up depending on where you are. And if you're out on the streets or in a public park, I'm not so sure you have the same protection that if you're out on somebody's lower 40.
But think about the problem that I have with the example is that we have surveillance cameras all over that are being used for, hey, can we do traffic management? Can we do better incident response if there's a car crash instead of waiting for someone to dial 911? We can actually see it happen, or we can see traffic happening. We can start controlling traffic lights and migrate traffic around to avoid that area. But if we rolled the clock back to when you were a kid, there was no ability for the government to surveil you in mass like that. And now you've made an arrangement with some private company and they're pulling you out of those data that you didn't make an agreement with them to store your data for law enforcement usage. You did it for things pretty much like advertising. I mean, if you're getting a product for free, like Google Maps, they're doing something with the data, but I don't think that the design was not to give it to law enforcement. The design was to be able to analyze your particular behavior patterns to sell you advertisements. Or sell advertisements to you, not to be a snitch to the police by hundreds of thousands or tens of thousands of people.
Well, it gets very murky, and like the answer to Jeff earlier, we just don't know.
Sure.
We truly don't know this, because the police generally, to go beyond certain boundaries, have to have a particularized reason. So to merely go through video and use facial recognition, which is what this article is about, to figure out who someone is a bit like fishing. We don't allow the police to go fishing. If we allow the police to knock at doors and randomly pick cars with no individualized suspicion and search cars, we would come up with a lot of contraband, both at the doors and the homes and the vehicles. We would do that, but we don't allow that. Even when they're out in public, we don't allow the police to intrude in a person's privacy. But I'm having a little bit of trouble with your face in the crowd being an intrusion in your privacy, because you're voluntarily out in public, and we're a surveillance society. We're almost as bad as London has been for the last 20 years. We've caught up with them. You're out in public, and anyone could be videoing you at any time. Now, the average citizen doesn't have the ability to convert that to an individual's identity, but the police do. So the question is whether they should have to have a warrant to convert a particular image. Should they have some articulable reason to convert an image to an identity that they would have to go to a judge to ask for that, or can they just do it because they have the technology? That's the unanswered question. We don't know.
Couldn't this be to like if we compared it to the TSA, the first things that they released, like they were seeing your junk, and now they have basic, like very, you know, just anatomically sort of close cartoon figures, and it says that there's something that they have detected on your thigh. So then they go over there and they, you know, they hit you with the back of their hand on your thigh to see if something is there. They could take the faces that they can discern and run those through and only turn. They don't need to get every Tom, Dick, and Harry that they see. They could just get whether they like go in and say, we are looking for this individual. We are looking for the Boston Bombers. And they know the faces that they're looking for and only return the people that they get hits on and not get the identity of every person. They don't need to know that every person was at that rally.
Well, again, I agree with you on that premise, but when suppose they're using the video to try to identify a suspect, and they've got the video from either a private source or from it was on a pole in public that the government owns, and they see a person that looks kind of like that, and they want to run that person. This writer says that they should go to the court and get. They should articulate the probable cause. They should say what happened and why they need to convert that to an identity. And that's the unanswered question. Should they have to do that, or should they be able to just do it because they can?
God, to me, they should have to get a warrant. To me, they should. For something like that, to do the facial recognition stuff. But well, I don't know that we can stop it at this point.
Well, that's what the writer is saying. That's what Mr. Claypool says in this article, mm-hmm. that they should have to do that, and it's not going to be the end of all life as we know it. But I can tell you one thing. The police will tell you it'd be the end of all life as we know it if they had to do that, because they don't want to give up any usage of any tool that they have.
Yes.
So once they've been using this, they're not going to want to have to go articulate why they want to convert facial recognition to an identity.
What about the extension of that, of the political side of that, not just for law enforcement, but now we know your political rivals, and if we should happen to move somewhere closer to some kind of tyranny, and now we start bullying, you know, if you're at these rallies, there's probably some level that you could say that these people lean this way politically, and now the other side could push against those people from a political point of view and intimidate, do more voter suppression kind of things just to keep those people from gaining any power.
Those are legitimate fears, and I think we're already seeing at least allegations of that blue states are being punished for not going along with the program. Yep. I'm just saying those allegations. I'm not pronouncing that that's happening, but I'm saying those allegations are out there.
Yep. All right, have we beat that dead horse far enough?
I think we have.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
The next thing is going to be from the Supreme Court of the State of Illinois. Did I pronounce that right, Larry?
I think that's right on the mark. Illinois. I like that.
I was gonna
say Illinois, but I guess it's Illinois.
All right. This is a case that is pretty recent. When did this one? June 18th. That's like 9 days ago. And I think this is related to parks again. Is that right?
It is. And it's a very, very troubling case. And in fact, NARSL issued a statement that was issued to a writer who contacted NARSL about what their take on it was. And we composed a statement of what we thought about it. This was a person who's miner was at a park, and it's not clear the age of the miner, but from all description, it looks like a pretty young kid because they're talking about T-ball. Okay. And but the kid was at a park, and the father went to the park to retrieve his miner, and a local police officer recognized him and went and had a visit with him. And he called the police department. He was off duty, but he called his department and reported it. And then the department went and visited him, and then they decided to prosecute him for being in the park. And it was my opinion, and I helped compose the statement that Narsil issued. It was my opinion that the lawyering was not particularly good in this case. And we have the benefit of 2020 hindsight. But the defense that should have been perfected on appeal was the necessity defense. And the necessity defense is where you say that you did something. Yes, I in fact affirm I did it. It's one of the many affirmative defenses that are out there. Which means you concede the underlying conduct, but you say that you should be forgiven. Insanity defense is an affirmative defense. Self-defense is an affirmative defense. You say, yeah, I shot the SOB, but I did it for these reasons, and I should be excused. Well, he had the necessity defense, which was that his minor was in the park, and he was trying to retrieve the minor. And the judge said he was overruling the necessity defense, and he did not brief that on appeal. So therefore, it wasn't considered on appeal. He had these really clever defenses he was going to use instead, and he said that because there were two sections of Illinois law, 11-9-4.1, 11-9.3, and he said that since one of them provided a defense, that the other one should. It provided the defense, and he wanted the court to incorporate into the statute a defense that wasn't there by the legislative. The legislature had not provided for. So he was asking the court to do a little bit of legislating from the bench. And all of our people that listen to this podcast, they do not believe in legislating from the bench, right?
Absolutely not. They have the black robes, and they should only hear the evidence and rule on the evidence.
Well, and so therefore, his assertion that there should have been a defense, because under the more serious felony charge, there is a defense that you can assert that excuses you because you're accompanying a minor and you're talking to a minor only because you're accompanying a minor and that minor is with you. But in this, just simply being present, there is no defense. And he said there should be a defense, and the court said, well, maybe there should be, but it's not our job to put it in there. And we don't legislate from the bench here. Which I'm hoping there's just this massive round of applause going in the audience now, because since we're so dead set on having textualist interpretation and no legislating from the bench, this is exactly what you would want. This decision would be precisely what a textualist interpretation would yield. So that's the main reason I put it in here, because it's another chance for me to say, well, they went right by the text. The text isn't against the law, and therefore, they didn't legislate from the bench. He's guilty of a misdemeanor. If he gets convicted of this again, it'll be a felony. And his appeal was not perfected on the necessity defense. Therefore, he loses.
I was reading through here that it also says that his wife, I believe it was, or at least the kid's mom was out of town. The defendant testified that his fiance was out of town and no one else was available to retrieve CG from the park that night. Larry, like, what are you supposed to do? Like, your kid is now not home, and you are now looking for said kid, and you have no other adults that could act on your behalf to go retrieve said kid. So you're just supposed to now you got DFACs or whatever you want to call those agencies. Now they're coming after you for child neglect. This is Hobson's choice. Is that the right word?
It is indeed. And of course, the court said he could have called the police, and they would have retrieved the kid. But okay. they also would have called called protective services. But again, the court did say that the legislature should go back and visit this again. But it's a legislative problem. I mean, the court didn't create this mess, and there should be a defense. And he should have, in all fairness, the lawyer should have perfected that necessity defense, and he shouldn't have dropped it on appeal. He should have, he or she should have really hit that hard and told the appellate court, yes, he did go in the park, and that's exactly what any parent would do.
It says in the law, it is unlawful for any child sex offender to knowingly be present in any public. Well, God, knowingly? That means you have to then know that you're somewhere? Or park building, playground, recreation area within any publicly accessible, privately owned building, blah, blah, blah. Any public park when persons under the age of 18 are present in the building, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, you can't be at a park if you have some sort of child offense. And apparently he did that. God, dude, you have no ability to survive this one. Because I didn't think about the police one that they're going to call defects too when that's over.
Oh, yeah. You're screwed. Because when you call the police and say, I've lost control of my kid, they're gonna report that to Protective Services.
So if you go, you get arrested and charged with a misdemeanor. And if you just let the kid run around, then defects is going to get called. And then if you try to call the police to try and retrieve them, you're screwed. There's no win around this one.
There is no win. And what this illustrates is the people out there that are so paranoid that they're going to get prosecuted at the drop of a dime, that shows that those people are absolutely correct. Because yes, this shows that a police agency has so little to do that they had the manpower, the person power, can't say manpower anymore, but they had the human resources and capital to prosecute this. This shows that the state's attorney's office in this jurisdiction had so much resources that they were able to perfect a prosecution. And this is exactly the reason why we're trying to, in some way, lessen the funding available for these agencies, because they brought this case. And if they had fewer resources, they would have had to have made a choice to bring this case. But Officer Corrigan didn't have any trouble. He had plenty of time. This is called the Mendota Police. I have no idea where that is, but it's in LaSalle County, wherever that is, probably near Chicago. But they had plenty of time. The state's attorney's office had plenty of time. And this is why when we say we're not talking about abolishing law enforcement, we're talking about reducing the reach of law enforcement. If they didn't have the reach to do this prosecution, they wouldn't have done it. So the people out there that are so paranoid they're going to get prosecuted because the hovercraft, there might be merit in some of that paranoia.
Yeah, I was actually going to bring that up. So the hovercraft was working on this because the officer recognized him. I don't have any affiliation with any sort of law enforcement to have a relationship that they would recognize me. That's me personally. I don't think any of them would recognize me because I avoid them like the plague. So how did Officer Corrigan testify that he went to the defendant's residence later that night? When asked about his presence in the park, defendant stated he was there. I'm sorry, I read something else somewhere in here that went like he recognized him.
Yeah, he recognized him at the park, yes. But it's
That's
like
crazy.
What's the population of that town? That could tell you. But I would bet that people might recognize you don't think recognize them because that's their job, is to recognize people. So I bet you'd be surprised how many of them would recognize you in public.
That's okay. Could be. What am I looking up? What's the name of this? LaSalle County.
I'm looking up Mendota to see how many people that they have.
LaSalle County is 108,000 people. That's a pretty decent place.
And the population of this town is 7,300 in 2010. It's 85
miles. Okay, everybody recognizes everybody.
It's 85 miles west of Chicago. I thought by being LaSalle, that would be because that's a name that's common in Chicago.
Hey, you remember that case 2-ish years ago where the kid threw himself off the garage after he got accused of doing naughty things?
Yes.
That's just to the northeast. That's Naperville. Or Naper. It was Naper. So that's just to the northeast of there.
Well, at least people have gotten me admitting that their paranoia might be not be so over the top because everybody's worried about the hovercraft. Like in this case, the hovercraft was there.
Absolutely. Anything else you want to point out on this one before we move on?
I think that this is a tragedy, and I think that there needs to be a challenge again and again. The legislature is not going to change the law unless they're forced to, but I think there needs to be a challenge brought by anybody who's subject to this restriction, properly built, adequately funded, And people are going to have to bring forth the issue about that he tried to raise, that he was not able to parent his kid, that you're not able to use publicly funded resources. This has to be hit every way possible. This is a ridiculous law.
Very well. How about we cover an article from the Deseret? What is Deseret? I've never heard of this word, Larry. Deseret. It sounds like desert. Anyway, Utah Supreme Court strikes down law allowing sex abuse lawsuits in case against federal judge. This thing says that there's going to be, like, you remember, we always talk about the U-Haul problem where everyone's going to get a U-Haul van and move to Utah. They almost like said this in here. Says if I feel like they just want to put a welcome mat out for Utah and any predator who wants to abuse children. It's a predator friendly state as long as this is the way we handle things, and it's not right.
So what's your question?
I don't necessarily have a question, but you put the article in here. It wasn't me that did it.
Did I put this in here?
I believe so. Anyway, why? So I don't ever think that this is how anything would go down anyway, even if it's less bad than other places. I mean, like, there's still going to be a registry and there's still going to be monitoring of people. No one's just going to fall off the radar, I don't think.
So, well, the reason I put it in, I do recall putting it in the Supreme Court, the Utah Supreme Court, that has struck down a law that allowed victims of sexual abuse to sue decades later. You know where I am on this issue, and anybody who listens regularly knows that I have great problems with decades later lawsuits. I don't think you can defend yourself. The standard of proof is so low in a civil case compared to a criminal case where it's beyond a reasonable doubt. And I'm okay with the ruling.
Surprisingly. So this is a statute of limitations things where they're rolling it back to making it, I don't even know that I saw a number in here of how many years, like New York did 55 years or something like that. How long did they roll it back here?
I didn't read the 22-page opinion. In fact, I couldn't find it anywhere. So, but yes.
I don't even see it in the article. I don't see any sort of any number. Anyway, so they have rolled back some kind of statute of limitations to where umpteen bajillion years later that you can be sued for something that happened and no one can defend anybody. Houses don't exist. Evidence doesn't exist. Memories fail and so forth. But someone says they made you feel squishy. And now they can sue you. And so you're saying civilly, tell me what the difference is between a civil suit and a criminal suit.
Well, in a criminal prosecution, the standard of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt, which it's a little unclear. I mean, no one can know what constitutes reasonable doubt. It's different with each juror. But with a civil suit, they make it clear that it's just 50%, slightly above 50% of the evidence. So in order to prevail in a civil lawsuit, you only have to show that it's more likely than not that it happened. And then in a civil lawsuit, they're generally going after the deep pockets. They don't really care about you unless you have deep pockets. You're just the weight of the deep pockets. So if you were a clergy person with the Catholic Church, or if you were, in this case, a federal judge, they're going after the deep pockets. And you're the judge may not have anything but his little paltry $139,000 or $150,000 salary. But the federal government has unlimited printing presses, and they're running them 24 hours a day, 7 days a week right now. I don't even know if they can keep up running them that much, but that's what they're going after. And this is all about the money. And I know I sound very insensitive, but if you're going to be forced to defend yourself against something that's being alleged that happened decades ago, no one can do that. It's ridiculous. Yeah. No one can do that. I mean, do you have a diary of where you were in 1997? On July 17th?
Definitely. Definitely. At 8 p.m. I knew it. I have to tell you, Larry, that prior to my involvement with this whole issue, I've been like, yes, you should always be able to go back and charge somebody and bring them and try to get restitution and all those things. You should always be able to go do that no matter when, because how do you serve justice if there's a timeline for it? I'm pretty sure I would have felt that way going the other direction.
You would have, and it's one of the talking points. They say justice shouldn't have an expiration date.
Sure, but I would also. It's probably an ill conceived. Like, it sounds good. Like, hey, this person had these bad things happen. JonBenet Ramsey. Like, we should always be able to go get the killer of JonBenet Ramsey, but start scaling things back that someone made me feel squishy. Whatever that. but how it's never looked at from the defense side that you could be accused and you could be innocent of it and you need the ability to defend yourself. And that's a really hard pill to swallow, Larry. I just, you know, just to be honest with you, it's harder to swallow that one.
Well, I mean, no one is saying that a federal judge should be abusing anybody. That's not the issue here. The issue here is how do we preserve our beautiful system of due process of law and fundamental fairness? No one wants anybody with power abusing anybody.
The victims' advocates just have a much easier tugging at your heartstrings narrative to pull on that one to roll back any sort of protections without considering constitutionally protected processes.
Well, it's they don't relate to it could happen to them, and they don't analyze the importance of the people fought and died for these protections of our Constitution, and they're so willing to just give them away. You know, this is, if we actually adhere to our Constitution, it's a beautiful creation.
I understand completely, my friend. So let's go over to our almost last article. And this is from, the name of it is DCIST, is the name of the publication, but it's DCIST. And it says, Virginia Democrats hope to drop mandatory minimum sentencing. Wow. So that would be probably a good thing. Mandatory minimums are a very troubling thing that if you want a judge to be a judge, then shouldn't they be allowed to go and look at you and your totality of your situation and your life and all that and go, I don't want this person to have a 10-year minimum or a 5-year or 20-year minimum. I think that maybe they should only get a couple years and then some probation and just sort of like, you know, use the expression, hit them with kid gloves. But if you have mandatory minimums, then the judge can't do anything, and he just has to hand you the 400 years that you get.
Yeah, I think we played a clip some number of episodes back where a judge said that I didn't impose this on you.
Yeah,
we should all have dubiosity, Andy, because this is a bunch of liberal Democrat Party activists in Virginia, and they're trying to, I mean, they're opening a floodgate of criminality by taking the tools of the prosecution away, and they're trying to insert their left-wing agenda into this, and I can't imagine that you could support such nonsense as this to take away mandatory.
You know that's how I feel, right? Do you think it'll pass, though?
I do. I think it'll pass on a party line vote. It'll be one of those blue versus red things. Unfortunately, I don't think many Republicans will want to do away. I hope I'm wrong, but I don't think many Republicans will want to do away. And I think that the Democrat Party will get demagogued for their actions. They'll be accused of turning loose a tidal wave of crime. But I do think it'll pass, and I think the governor will sign it. And you know, isn't it interesting? This governor, not that long ago, they were calling on him to resign for his blackface.
Yes,
and he said, "I'm not going anywhere." And you know, there's nobody calling for his resignation. At least I'm not hearing about it nationally. Maybe they're calling
nothing going on in that regard.
So
but, that all went away. It seems I wonder why that went away. Just it seemed to almost just evaporate. Maybe it was I don't know. That was a year ago that was going. What happened to that got squashed out of the media so very quickly?
It's a conspiracy of the left wing, the Democrat Party control media.
I don't know why. I see.
You don't understand this stuff. It's very obvious that the drive by media is leftist controlled by the Democrat Party.
You know, you're saying all that stuff, and I'm very sensitive to the emails that we've gotten lately about that. you've told me that I should not worry about it, but I do consider it. I even went and took one of the articles that we dropped, and I went and looked for the same coverage from one of the right wing nut job places, just so we could be balanced.
Well, I would say that I listen to talk shows I don't agree with. I would never listen to KKOB and Rush Limbaugh and the conservative crowd over there if I expected to agree with them. I listen to them to be informed and to understand their perspective. And to try to give them the benefit of the doubt. That I don't believe that people I disagree with are trying to destroy America. Now, unfortunately, they say that about us. We're trying to tear down the country. I believe that they're misguided. But if you're listening to us, you're not going to agree with us on everything that we talk about here. But hopefully we're giving a different perspective that you may not have considered. But if you're expecting to agree with us, you probably should just turn the podcast off.
But it's so, I mean, we were accused of like purporting like conspiracy theories of the left. And I was like, I'm still trying to figure out what that related to exactly.
Well, I have bashed the left quite a bit. So anybody who listens regularly knows that I tried my best to cut it down the middle. And this Democrat stuff, I'm doing this tongue-in-cheek because I resent the term Democrat Party. That's not the name of the party. And I wish they would say the Democratic Party. And I don't think they should be offended if I say the Republican Party. They're not going to pronounce the party correctly. But the Democrat Party is not always right. And I say that. I wish the people who are members of the Republican Party would say our party is often wrong. Our party, our Democratic Party, we're not right about everything. We're right in my view more. I think we're right more than they are. That's why I'm in the Democratic Party. But we're wrong about things. I'll give you an example. The $600 extra unemployment benefits. There was dissension about that extra benefit, whether it would discourage work. The Democrats were right in one regard, that if you force employers to close down and don't allow them to work, that they should be compensated at a level consistent with what they would have been earning had they allowed them to work. The Republicans are right when they say, well, that's nice, except for the people who are getting the extra $600 in many instances are receiving more than what they were earning working. Therefore, it disincentivizes work. They were both right.
Sure. We had to disincentivize work so people didn't need to go out and go do things that they would do otherwise that would help promote spreading of the virus.
But I don't know that was a major consideration. I think it was trying to keep the purchasing power up of what the people that were not allowed to work would have been spending. I think that was more the consideration. But the Republicans are right that if you're earning $200 a week, and I know a particular instance where a person that was earning less than $200 now is getting close to $800, counting the $600 add-on. That person has absolutely no incentive to go to work. The Republicans are right. But the Democrats were right that the people who were earning $900 a week, since most state unemployment benefits are usually in the $400 a week or less range, we shouldn't cut them from $900 a week to $400 a week and not allow them to earn anything else without making some both sides were right.
I hear you. Well, let's go over something that we probably should have covered last week. You've been using crappy old telephone technology, but this is from Torsileri, whatever. That's the name of the appellee from Pennsylvania. This is I don't even know what this is about, Larry. What is this whole case about?
Stuff.
All right, cool. And then we're done.
Oh. Well, this is Teresa with us tonight? I haven't looked.
I have not seen her. She is not here.
Okay, so this is the ongoing saga of registration in Pennsylvania. And just for any first-time listeners or people who have missed previous episodes where we've talked about Pennsylvania, there has been so much litigation in that state. And law changed in 2012. They adopted what they considered to be their version of the Adam Walsh Act in 2012. It took effect December 20th, I believe, 2012. And that changed the system altogether and put in the 15, 25, and lifetime registration, and it made it retroactive. And the Supreme Court in Pennsylvania decided in 2017 in Munez that was unconstitutional for those whose crimes predated 2012. And so the legislature decided to do a fix. So they came up with a version of the registry that was less onerous for people whose crimes predated 2012. And they came up left the previous version. They left what they had passed in 2012 in effect for people. This guy's conviction occurred in 2017, so he was subject to the more onerous requirements of the law, and and he contested that within his criminal case. He said that the registration applied to him was unconstitutional. The trial judge agreed. I wish I could find the 70-something page opinion. That's why I was hoping Teresa was here, because I'd like to read the 70-something page opinion. But the trial judge agreed, he or she, that the registration requirements of the newly enacted law was unconstitutional. And this is the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's decision on the trial judge. And I like this decision. I wish they had affirmed, but I see this decision as leading towards an affirmance later. They're giving the state a chance to prove that this recidivism is frightening and high, and they didn't do it in the criminal case, and they're giving them a chance. The dissenting justice here said that they shouldn't be allowed that opportunity, but sending it back for the trial judge to develop the record. But the fact that the trial judge wrote a 72-page opinion, at least, because I see references all the way up to page 72, so you couldn't reference 72 pages if it was only 20 pages. So I see references, so it's at least 70, 80 pages. The trial judge is going to come up with the exact same outcome after the Commonwealth has allowed an opportunity to present the non-existent evidence. And we're going to be right back where we are at some point in the future. It's just unfortunate it's going to take many more months because we have to go back and we have to have a trial, take evidence, and then the state will undoubtedly appeal again because the judge is going to decide the same thing he decided the first time. And this is going to go up on appeal again. It's going to cost more money. But ultimately, this is going to end well for the people in Pennsylvania. So I'm encouraged by this.
And what is, so you said it's going to end well for the people of Pennsylvania. Does that mean somebody with a conviction prior to the date you said, they won't have these registration requirements?
Well, this was for I believe, a person who had after that date. They passed a two-prong registry after the Muniz decision. They passed Act 10 and then I think Act 29. I'm doing this from memory. Yeah, they reenacted basically Act 10 with Act 29, and they've tried to make it a little less punitive. And rather than having to come in, they're trying to get away from the disabilities or restraint of the registry, which is one of the seven Kennedy Mendoza Martinez factors. And they said that since you get to report in telephonically, that it's not the same. And the judge just poo-pooed that. I've highlighted where the trial judge just said, that's just nonsensical. You're still, and then under the revised law, you can petition after 25 years for removal. And the state argued, well, that's enough. You've got some due process. And the judge says, well, your life is ruined after 25 years. What good is being able to petition off after 25 years? So the Supreme Court called them out on some of their bogus arguments in this. I love it every time the state gets called out for their duplicity and their nonsensical arguments.
What about the Pennsylvania piece that comes up every now and then about their reputation, that they have something of a constitutionally protected thing of their reputation?
That applies here, but the Supreme Court said that wasn't fully developed. Everything that the trial judge ruled on, they sent it back for evidence. They relied entirely on
Torsolieri, they relied on him
entirely and his experts, and the state didn't bring in anyone, and now the state is saying that you got it wrong, so they're giving the state a chance. But I don't see that changing. I think I had highlighted something on 13 I was going to quote and see if I can figure out what it was. Says, nonetheless, we're unable to conclude based upon the record currently before this court whether Appley has sufficiently undermined the validity of the legislative findings supporting revised subchapter H registration notification provisions, especially in light of the contradictory scientific evidence cited by the Commonwealth during this appeal, which may refute Appley's experts. It's not the role of an appellate court, I'm still quoting, to determine the validity of the reference studies based on mere citations rather than allowing the opportunity for the truth to develop through a hearing on the merits of the evidence. Accordingly, a remand is appropriate to allow the parties to address whether a consensus has developed to call into question the relevant legislative policy decisions impacting offenders' constitutional rights. So the record is just not enough as it existed. But there's a lot of good highlighted portions in here where the state got called out for their BS.
BS, is that a legal term?
No. It says the court opined, it's talking about the trial judge, a post-deprivation process that provides for a hearing concerning the deprivation of fundamental right that occurs 25 years after the injury is akin to a provision of no process at all. The court emphasized that during the intervening 25 years, the adult offenders will have effectively placed out of the job market, ostracized from pro-social resources, and unduly stigmatized for the majority of their most productive years. I mean, this judge clearly gets it.
Definitely. And then how long would it take before this ends back up at the for some sort of decision?
Well, it's hard to say. I would be surprised if it's less than 2 years, but the judge is going to have to conduct a trial. And the state, of course, is going to whine that they're going to drag their feet. And the judge, depending on how busy the docket is going to have to schedule, block out some time for a trial. And then the appeal will take whatever amount of time it takes to work its way back up to the court. So I would say another couple of years before we have the outcome finalized.
And in the meantime, it's just in limbo. It runs the current state.
Okay. Yes. It's important to note. I keep highlighting about the clearest of proof can override the legislature's when the legislature passes something, it's presumed constitutional. And when the legislature makes a finding, as I've highlighted on page 19, the court says we emphasize that only the clearest of proof of punitive effect can override the legislature's stated intent that the statute be construed as non-punitive. So you're starting out with the legislature gets the benefit of the doubt.
So you're already, and then you have to prove them wrong, and does that have to be at a constitutional level? Because we can make bad laws that are stupid but constitutional, to quote somebody.
Yes.
So you would have to then prove to the court that what they are doing is then unconstitutional for have a judge push back and roll something
yes.
back.
Yes, you don't.
And not
have
even necessarily roll it back. They just say you can't do that.
Yes, people can completely misconstrue. The courts don't exist to save you from a bad choice you made to elect people who pass bad laws from a policy perspective. The courts can only intervene when there's a constitutional right being trampled. And I keep bringing up the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. They could bring that back tomorrow if they wanted to. It's a bad policy.
Stupid.
We've learned that. It would be detrimental to our economy and to society as a whole, but we have the right to have a bad policy.
I gotcha. Are we done with this one?
Yeah, we're going to finish within 90 minutes because
I doubt it.
Oh, you have more?
I doubt it because there was an email question that I don't remember where I pulled it from. I think I pulled it from somebody asking a question to one of the organizations. And it says, I actually added, it says, what I'm interested in mostly is the rights to practice my Christian duties to the church. It says, I am interested in working with you in any way possible to foment desperately needed changes to these blanket policies, which judge and punish all by the canon of the worst. This violates our constitutional guarantee to due process. In my case, in which there is no physical victim, I possess 14 images, blah, 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 I am forced to live under restrictions which, among other things, infringes on my rights to practice my Christian duties to the church. I am writing a book to expose the horrific prison conditions and practices, as well as to expose dozens of violations of the law and criminal procedures committed by the police, prosecutor, and judge in my case. It is being fought in court. The state rules by fear, not by common sense. This is only a cursory overview of my position and issue, and I would like to discuss it more in depth. Sex laws are largely based on fear and political pandering and ignore the driving force behind many of these crimes and pseudo-crimes. Please email me when you can, blah, blah, blah. So my question to you is, in regard to this, is when you get all of these restrictions put on you, doesn't that infringe on your, again, First Amendment rights to be involved in church and your right to, like, do all of those religious things? And hasn't anybody tried to push on that button?
Well, and I know you hate it when I say this, but I don't have all the information that would be necessary for this question, so we can develop it further. What we don't know is whether he's still being punished, if the writer is still serving a part of his sentence, meaning if he's under any supervision. You have fewer rights when you're under supervision than when you're not under supervision. When you're paying a debt to society, the infringement into your space can be more. Now, it's not unlimited, but there can be more infringement. So we don't know if he's being punished or if he's just simply a part of the civil regulatory scheme. So it'd be helpful if we knew that. And it would be helpful if he is being punished, it would be helpful if we could know if there's anything that they can articulate individual. You can impose a lot of conditions on an offender that's under supervision if they're uniquely tailored, narrowly tailored, and unique to that offender. So the convicting offense, we've got the part about the 14 images, but what we don't know is there's the rule of 404B. What we don't know if there's anything in his background that came out in his PSR of any uncharged conduct or anything he was under investigation for that was dismissed as a part of this case to induce the plea. They sometimes tell you you're under investigation for blah, 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 and we'll wrap that up and conclude there'll be no prosecution. We don't know if they could articulate an individualized reason for not allowing him go to a particular church. But what we do know is they can't tell him he can't go to church at all. If he is being forbidden to worship, that's going to be extremely problematic in terms of the Constitution. You have that right.
And Christian duties to the church. So, I mean, he could be volunteering as the bookkeeper. If the 14 images were allegedly taken at the church, then I could see everybody tailoring all of the things saying that you can't do church because you obviously have done something involving the church. But if you just happen to end up with them on your computer from random internet places, I have no understanding of why they would then restrict you from church if it's not related to it.
Well, but see, again, the Christian duties, he's being a little bit vague. What are those Christian duties that he's talking about? Does he think he has a Christian duty to lead a Sunday school class that's composed of adolescents? We know that if he's in trouble for images, they had to be underage because we don't prosecute people for looking at adult porn in this country, to my knowledge. So we know that there is some relationship to underage individuals that would constitute the base for the prosecution. So is his Christian duties, is he talking about sweeping the floors when the church building is empty, or is he talking about having more responsible role in the church? He's a little unclear on that as well. So we don't know what he's asserting that he should have the right to do. And we don't know whether he's being punished or not, or if he's simply being prohibited by the registry, so that we would need to develop this a little bit further.
A friend of mine was even told that he couldn't be the, God, I'm going to, I forgive me for not knowing the term, the person that collects the tithing. I don't know what the person's title is, but he couldn't even do that because that could possibly expose him to interact with children, which to me seems completely ridiculous because it's not like you're going to go collect tithings from like a room full of children. There are going to be many other people in the room that would be not supervising you, but be observing you doing that. And if you tried to do something naughty with a child while nobody is looking, there's 100 people sitting in the room or 1,000 people sitting in the room with you. That seems ridiculous.
Well, but again, is that person being punished or is that a registry requirement?
He's currently being punished.
I agree with you that I think it's ridiculous to say a person, I think they would call that an usher in most churches, but to say a person can't be an usher,
said that in chat.
I think that would be a ridiculous But on the other hand, can you imagine, you got to remember, all this is political.
Yes.
Can you imagine, I mean, I'm guessing that in whatever church it is, there's at least one cell phone camera, wouldn't you?
Totally.
Okay. I can only imagine that if a cell phone camera were to capture a registered sex offender, a PFR, going down the aisle, collecting tithings at a church, and posted that on Facebook, what would be the reaction in that community about that? What would you think the congregation would be supportive, or do you think that that
I
would?
I think we could find enough that would go on either side of that. You would find some that would want to roast the person and be like, "No, we know his situation and we love this person and everything's great, so continue on and F you for being stupid." I can see we could get it both ways.
Now, when Brent does the transcript, is he going to be able to put Facebook in the transcript, or should he put Facebook?
I think he should put Facebook, because that's what you said. We should have it be exactly as you spoke it and not as as it should be written out.
Oh, so, but you see the dilemma that the church would find themselves in, and the probation people would find themselves in, because in many states, that the fact the person's under supervision would be a public record. It's on the website of supervised offenders. So when the camera rolls into the probation department and says, the citizens of this county would like to know why there's a registered sex offender serving as an usher in the First Baptist Church, which the First Baptist Church may not be a good example, but you know, pull that out of thin air. What would the reaction be of the community?
I mean, if it comes out on that kind, yeah, then everything's going to go south probably pretty quickly. Because, you know, like the sheriff in Butts County for putting the signs out, like, thanks, sheriff, for keeping us safe from these terrible people. It's going to be that same kind of reaction.
Yep, that's what I'm afraid of. And I think that, although I hate to sound like I'm defending these people, I'm not. You have to get in their head and understand how they come up with this stuff. That doesn't make you agree with it. It helps you understand how they get to where they are.
It's funny that I have conversations with people, and thank you, Larry, that you've actually like ruined many relationships that I have with people. Everything is political. Someone says, well, I don't like how this regulatory board does this thing. And I'm like, that's politics, because that regulatory board was put forth by some governor or some city thing. And without, you know, if we voted differently, then those regulations would be different. I'm not saying that they are good or bad, but I'm just saying if it's because of how we vote that we have these, you know, haircut regulations or real estate regulations. We have all of these things that are controlled by politics.
Well, as we sign off tonight, people explain this to me next episode. How is it that you can live in a country, this very system is designed, we live in a political system, we have parties, we live in a representative system where people have to go out and compete for votes and be attractive candidates. Everything that happens, whether it be at the local level, in terms of whether you're going to get a sidewalk paved and a street paved versus we're going to get another load of gravel and a grading, or whether you're going to get a library built, or whether we're going to get 18 more Nimitz-class carriers, if they still build those. All those things are political decisions. All those things are whether we're going to have an extra $600 a week in unemployment benefits. How is it that you can claim that you're not political when we live in a system where everything that happens is determined by a political process? Would you guys please explain that to me?
I wasn't interested in it 15 years ago, Larry. That's the only thing out of this that I can explain to you.
But our whole system, every decision that's made is political.
And somewhere, I don't know where it is, but people immediately say something like, ugh, I hate politics. And that's just the end of it. And it becomes almost like math, and people either like math or they hate math. There's probably not really very many people that are in between. And somehow politics ends up to be kind of sort of the same thing. They just hate all of it. And I've become kind of like fascinated by it. You know, I listen to politics podcasts like almost exclusively to just hear about all the meanderings and the jockeying back and forth and who says what and whether this is constitutional or appropriate and whatnot. It's pretty fascinating to me at this point. Thanks, Larry, for ruining my life.
Well, do you prefer an authoritarian regime? Do you prefer a dictatorship? I mean, what's the alternative?
I think North Korea would be way better. Kim Jong-un would be way better, and he can just say, nope, you messed up, I'm going to kill your family and your grandparents and then your kids too, something like that. That sounds way better.
How we run this nation is a battle of wills and for the soul of the people to win the people over to your way of thinking, or at least enough of them to prevail. That's our system. Sure. I don't know why that is so shocking to people. That's what we do. We govern ourselves by the majority as long as we don't trample the constitutional rights of the minority. Our system's designed so that the minority doesn't get totally trampled, but it is designed to do exactly what it does.
I agree. I understand now. I didn't understand then. You should have talked to me like 15 years ago, 20 years ago, and I would have punched you right in the face, Larry. you and your silly politics.
You people are too
much. We done? Anything else? I have one shout out to make before we sign off.
Yeah, I think we've done we're done, unless someone else in chat has another question. I see a thousand questions here.
I wanted to bring up that there's a new podcast out there by Dr. Alyssa Ackerman, and then also she is co-hosted by Alexis Sardina. I hope I pronounced that right. I've been listening to them. They're just getting started. It's called Beyond Fear. It's the Sex Grimes podcast. It's pretty good, and I like it. And you will hear from two doctors about how the PFRs and that whole industrial complex around it, how it's kind of garbage. And they are advocates on our side, and they are talking about from the PhD side of things.
Well, I will check that out on my podcast app.
I'm sure that you will, Larry.
I actually will.
Really? Did you get you got a new phone? Did you put a podcast app on there?
Of course, I did. I'm moving up in the world.
Oh my God, I'm shocked. Prior to what was your response when I asked you about doing a podcast?
I don't remember.
Your answer was like, what's a podcast?
Oh, that was years ago.
All right. Well, we could sign off. So find the podcast. You can find show notes at registrymatters.co. And of course, like Jeff did, you can leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. Email registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And of course, we love all of our listeners, but I want to send out a special super duper thank you to our patrons at patreon.com/registrymatters. And I will tell you that tonight we did some content before we started recording. And if you are not a patron, you will not be receiving the extra content this week. So you should go sign up even for $1 a month and you can get the Patreon extra that I'll be releasing this week. And with all that, Larry, I bid you adieu and I hope you have a splendid Saturday evening and I will talk to you soon.
Thanks, Andy.
Take care. Bye-bye.